Okay, let's dive into something that feels, well, incredibly familiar, but might just be far more complex and surprising than we think. We've got a stack of material here, drawing heavily from Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino's work and, years of reflection on the Ten Commandments.
That's right. This isn't just a quick look. We're really going to unpack what these ancient texts meant in their world, how they functioned, and what that might tell us about them and maybe ourselves today. Forget the simple rules people often quote. The sources suggest there's something deeper, a wisdom encoded here.
Absolutely. So our mission in this deep dive is really to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge, the insights that maybe challenge assumptions and help us and you understand these commandments in a new light. It's about seeing their historical context, their unique literary form, and uncovering some of that unexpected wisdom.
Yeah, think of it as bridging the gap between then and now, what Dr. Tomasino calls the merging of horizons. You really need to understand the world they were written in and then see how they resonate or perhaps deliberately contrast with our world.
So let's set the stage with the Ten Commandments themselves, sometimes called the Decalogue. The source material highlights they are incredibly practical, but that practicality, well, it only unlocks when we understand them in both their original context
The ancient Near Eastern
and
context.
our modern one.
They're really positioned as the foundational layer of the entire biblical law code. The big collection you find throughout Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, they're the bedrock.
And they hold this incredibly prominent, almost revered place in church tradition, often listed as one of the three big foundational documents of Christian faith.
Right, you've got the ethical, which is the Ten Commandments, the spiritual, the Lord's Prayer, and the theological, the Apostles' Creed. That's kind of the traditional triad.
But here's a crucial distinction raised by the source, challenging that common modern idea that these commandments are some kind of universal moral blueprint for any society.
Exactly. The argument here, based on the source, is that they are specifically crafted for a society that has entered into a very unique covenant relationship with and worships the God of Israel. They're not just general principles for everyone, everywhere.
And that immediately tells us they aren't just some magic wand you can wave to fix societal problems, right? Like the source mentions this idea of putting them up in courtrooms or classrooms and expecting things to change.
Yeah, it's not that simple. The source suggests they are wise instructions for a specific people in a specific relationship, not a universal quick fix.
Which makes the surprising lack of basic knowledge about them, even among people who value them highly, quite telling.
Oh, definitely. The source points to surveys suggesting the average Christian can only name about four, and few can even put them in the right order. It really shows how much we might assume we know versus what we actually, grasp about them.
Okay, so to truly understand the Ten Commandments, we probably need to take a step back and understand the whole concept of law itself, especially how it worked back then compared to now.
Right.
When we think of modern law, it's usually pretty rigid, like a rule made by the government, a speed limit. You go 1 mile over, technically you've broken the law.
Exactly. Our modern view often sees law as absolute, strictly enforced, black and white. But in the ancient Near East, the picture was, well, more complex and in some ways maybe more flexible.
How so?
Well, laws often grew out of existing tribal customs, oral traditions first. And then when powerful kings, these suzerains, took over diverse areas, they imposed their own law codes. Think of Ur-Nammu or Hammurabi in Mesopotamia.
Right, imposing order.
Yeah, and asserting authority. But here's the really interesting bit from the source. Ancient Near Eastern law was deeply rooted in a covenant relationship between the king and his people.
A covenant, like an agreement.
Sort of, yeah. The king wasn't just some distant ruler. He was seen as providing benefits, protection, order, maybe even prosperity. And that relationship, that covenant, gave him the right to impose obligations, which were the laws.
Okay, that makes sense. The benefits earned him the right to ask for something in return.
Pretty much. And to further legitimize their authority, these kings often claimed their laws had divine backing. Hammurabi's famous law code, you see that pillar? It shows him receiving the laws from the sun god, Shamash.
Ah, so it's authority from relationship and from the gods.
Exactly. Now, the source, drawing on scholars like Albrecht Dald, points out two main forms of law you see in the ancient world and the Bible. There's abuthikdik law, that's the direct, unqualified command, thou shalt or thou shalt not. Very straightforward.
Reckon the Ten Commandments.
Precisely. And then there's casuistic law, which is basically case law. It follows an if X happens, then Y should occur structure. If a man does this, then this is the consequence.
Got it. And the source says most ancient laws were actually that second type.
Yeah, the majority were casuistic. Think of those sometimes pretty graphic examples from Hammurabi's code.
Like the ox goring someone?
Right. If a man's ox is known to gore people and he doesn't pen it up and it kills someone, then the owner faces a penalty, maybe even death in some cases. Or that river ordeal thing.
Oh, yeah. Throw someone in the river to see if they float. Yikes.
Yeah, exactly. But here's a really surprising nugget from the source. Even with these detailed codes like Hammurabi's, court records suggest they weren't always enforced rigidly by judges.
Really?
Yeah. Penalties apparently varied. There seemed to be a fair amount of discretion, maybe even leniency or grace, built into the system. The codes functioned more like authoritative guidelines, perhaps, than absolute non-negotiable rules.
That's fascinating. Almost like a police officer having discretion about a speeding ticket today.
Kind of like that, yeah. A suggestion for how things should be handled, but with room for judgment. It's a very different feel from our modern expectation of strict, uniform application.
It really is.
Oh.
Okay, so that's the ancient Near East background.
Okay.
Now let's turn to biblical law. Specifically, the Hebrew word Torah. We usually just translate it as law, right?
We do. But the source argues that teaching or instruction actually captures its broader meaning much better. It's not just legal statutes.
That feels right somehow. Because Torah isn't just court rules. It includes things like wisdom instruction, like a parent teaching a child in Proverbs.
Exactly. Or the guidance given by the prophets. It's a much richer concept than just law.
And interestingly, the word Torah actually shows up before Moses at Mount Sinai.
Yeah, Genesis 26 mentions Abraham obeying God's Torah, his instructions or laws. It shows that the idea of following divine guidance was already around before the big Sinai event.
So the origin of Israelite law is seen as kind of analogous to that ancient Near Eastern pattern we talked about.
In a way, yes. But here, God himself is the sovereign, the king figure. He enters into this covenant relationship with the tribes of Israel.
Okay.
And within that relationship, he imposes his code, his instructions, his Torah. This would have interacted with whatever existing tribal customs groups like Judah or Levi already had for dealing with issues. God is essentially saying, look, within this covenant relationship, this is the way I want things done.
And this biblical law code, it wasn't just static, given once and done.
No. The source points out that even within the Torah itself, you see development. There are examples where a specific case comes up, like the blasphemy case in Leviticus.
Right.
And that leads to a new specific statute being added. It shows the law building on itself, responding to new situations over time based on the initial principles.
And then there's the role of Ezra later on. What's the thinking there?
Well, there's a theory, which the source mentions, that Ezra, who was a scribe and a legal expert, played a key role much later, possibly around the time of the Persian Empire.
Okay.
The idea is he might have codified the Pentateuch, the first five books, including the laws, and promulgated them with Persian backing, making them kind of the official law of the land for the Jewish community then.
Even though the traditions themselves were much older.
Exactly. The traditions and laws existed earlier, but maybe weren't always followed consistently. You know, prophets like Jeremiah complain bitterly about people ignoring laws like the Sabbath centuries before Ezra.
Right. Okay. So bringing it back specifically to the Ten Commandments again, their form is distinct. You said earlier they're overwhelmingly apodictic.
Yeah, those direct commands. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. Very clear, direct statements.
And here's a really striking feature, according to the source, setting them apart from most other ancient laws, even other biblical laws. The complete absence of stated penalties within the list itself.
That's huge. It doesn't say in the Ten Commandments what happens if you do kill someone or commit adultery. The consequences are detailed elsewhere in the law code, but not attached to these 10 core commands.
And that lack of penalties combined with a certain ambiguity in some of them.
Right. Like, honor your father and mother. What does that look like practically? Does it change when you're 5 versus when you're 50? Or remember the Sabbath day and do no work. What exactly counts as work?
The source mentions those old debates, right? Like, could you fluff a pillow with your head but not your hands on the Sabbath?
Exactly. Those rabbinic discussions highlight the inherent need for interpretation. They aren't always self-explanatory.
And then there's the kicker. The last commandment, you shall not covet. How on earth do you enforce that externally?
You can't. How do you police someone's inner desires, their thoughts, their longings? It's impossible from the outside.
So this really points to something deeper, doesn't it? They must be more than just external rules for society.
Absolutely. which leads to one of the central insights from the source. These are perhaps best understood not merely as absolute legal rules, but as covenant stipulations, obligations, promises almost.
Promises that Israel accepted as part of their unique relationship with God.
Yes. Think of it like, well, the source uses that powerful biblical metaphor of a marriage between God and Israel. You see it in prophets like Hosea or Ezekiel.
Okay, the marriage metaphor. How does that apply here?
Well, in that framing, the commandments function like wedding vows. Think about it. The very first commandment, you shall have no other gods before me, is essentially the foundational vow of exclusivity.
Like saying, I promise I won't cheat on you, forsaking all others.
Exactly. It's about relational faithfulness at its core. Mm-hmm. And those unenforceable commands, like not coveting, they point to a reliance on self-policing. Keeping those kinds of vows, the internal ones, depends on the people taking personal responsibility themselves to uphold their end of the covenant relationship. It's about internal commitment, not just external compliance.
Okay, that reframes them quite significantly. Now, what about looking at them from a historical critical angle? The source acknowledges there's skepticism out there, right?
Oh, yes. Scholarly skepticism about the, you know, miraculous elements of the Sinai story, the fire and smoke and all that. And even questions raised about whether Moses as a historical figure actually existed or received these laws directly.
Though the source offers a counterpoint.
It does mention the interesting detail of Moses having an Egyptian name, which Hebrew tradition seems to have preserved even without fully understanding its Egyptian origin. That's seen by some as a small piece of evidence supporting historicity. But yes, other views attribute the laws to later periods, just framed as Mosaic to give them that ancient authority.
And this whole discussion gets more complex because there are different versions, or at least apparent lists, of Ten Commands in the Bible itself.
Right. You've got the list we all think of, usually in Exodus 20, often called the Ethical Decalogue.
Okay.
Then there's this passage in Exodus 34. Now, the phrase Ten Commandments does appear nearby in the text there. Yeah. But the source argues it's probably referring to a larger collection or compendium of laws, not specifically the list of mostly ritual-focused rules mentioned right in that passage. Things like celebrating the Feast of Unleavened Bread, offering firstborns, the Feast of Weeks.
And that weird one about not cooking a young goat in its mother's milk.
Exactly. Those things aren't in the Exodus 20 list. So calling Exodus 34 the ritual decalogue might be a bit misleading according to the source.
Okay, so Exodus 20 is the main one.
Yeah.
But then there's Deuteronomy 5, which is very similar, but not identical.
Very similar, yes, but with some genuinely striking differences. And these differences are really insightful.
Like what? What's the big one?
The prime example is the reason given for keeping the Sabbath. In Exodus 20, the reason is creation. God created the world in 6 days and rested on the seventh, so you should rest too. It's rooted in the cosmic order.
Okay.
But in Deuteronomy 5, the reason given is the Exodus deliverance. It says, remember that you were slaves in Egypt and that the Lord your God brought you out. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day.
So it's about remembering liberation and giving rest to others because you know what hardship is.
Precisely. Remember being slaves. Remember God giving you rest. Now, extend that rest to everyone, your servants, your animals, even the immigrants among you, because you have that shared experience of suffering and liberation. The source sees Deuteronomy's reason as perhaps a later, more ethically developed reflection, appealing directly to Israel's moral experience.
That's a significant shift in rationale. Are there other differences?
Yes. Another interesting one is in the list for the commandment about coveting. Exodus 20 goes,
yeah.
House first, then wife, then male and female slaves, ox, donkey, anything else.
Okay.
Deuteronomy 5 changes the order. It puts the wife first, then the house, then it adds field, then male servant, the female servant, ox, donkey, anything else.
Wife first and adds field. Why it is?
Well, the source suggests putting the wife first in Deuteronomy might reflect a tradition trying, perhaps consciously, to separate the wife from being listed merely as part of the household property alongside slaves and animals. It elevates her status slightly in the list.
And adding field
could be simple clarification. Or maybe, as the source speculates, it brings the total number of coveted items specifically listed to 7, a number often symbolizing completion or wholeness in the Bible.
Interesting. So which version is considered the original?
Based on the source, the general consensus leans towards Exodus 20 being closer to the original form, with Deuteronomy 5 representing a slightly later reflection or adaptation. Reconstructions trying to get behind Exodus 20 are seen as much more speculative.
Okay, so looking at that Exodus 20 list, the structure itself, Is it just random, or is there a design to it?
The source argues strongly for intentional design. It's not random at all.
How does it break down?
Well, you've got Commandments 1 through 3 focus squarely on obligations to God. Exclusive worship, no idols, not misusing his name, your vertical relationship.
Makes sense. God first.
Then number 4, the Sabbath. This one's kind of a pivot or a bridge. It's definitely an obligation to God, remembering creation rest, but it's also deeply connected to the created order and the social structure.
Does it?
By mandating rest for everyone, servants, animals, the land itself in some traditions. It affects the whole community, the whole ecosystem, you could say.
Okay, so 1-3 God, 4 God, and society creation. What about 5? Honoring parents.
Right. Commandment 5 is fascinatingly placed. It marks the transition to obligations primarily concerning fellow human beings. And it comes before do not murder.
Why is that significant?
The source suggests this placement emphasizes the foundational importance of the family unit and respect for elders, the basic structures of society, before dealing with specific acts of harm against individuals like killing or stealing. Stability first, then specific wrongs.
Interesting order. Then 6-9.
Those deal with direct obligations to other people. Murder, adultery, stealing, false testimony, lying about someone, especially in court.
And the source suggests there's an order there, too.
Yeah, they seem to be arranged in a roughly descending order of severity in terms of the harm caused to the other person. Murder is obviously the most severe violation. Then perhaps adultery, seen as a deep violation of person and family. Then stealing property. Then damaging reputation through lies.
So it pushes back against that idea that all sins are equal.
Subtly, yes. It suggests a hierarchy of harm, at least in terms of societal impact. The source might put it like, would you rather someone steal your purse or murder you? Clearly, there's a difference in severity.
Right. And finally, number 10.
Coveting. This brings the focus entirely inward, addressing our inner life, our desires, our thoughts, the things that often lead to the outward actions forbidden earlier.
So the whole structure moves, kind of.
Logically, yeah. From our core relationship with God, 1-3, through the bridge of Sabbath connecting God and community, 4, into our duties towards others, starting with the family foundation, 5, then addressing major harms against others in descending order, 6-9, and finally culminating in the state of our own hearts and minds. It's quite elegant, really.
It really is. Okay, so understanding all that history, context, structure.
Yeah.
How do we translate these ancient texts into something meaningful for us today? The source stresses care is needed, right?
Absolutely. First and foremost, you have to read them in their historical and cultural context. For example, understanding what adultery meant specifically in ancient Israelite society, which had different structures and property concepts than we might have today.
And remembering who they were written for.
Critically important. They were designed for ancient Israel, which understood itself as a theocracy, a society where God's law was the civil law. The source is pretty clear that just lifting them out of that context and, say, posting them in a modern secular courtroom.
I missed the point.
Yeah, it might not be the wisest or most appropriate application because we simply are not that society. The values worked within that specific covenantal framework.
The source even has that slightly tragic view of them, doesn't it? Calling them a harbinger of Israel's failures.
Yeah, suggesting they almost foretold Israel's repeated inability to actually live up to these standards, especially that very first one about exclusive worship. History shows they struggled constantly with idolatry.
So context is key.
Hmm.
And for people reading these within a faith tradition,
then they absolutely must be understood within their full literary and theological context. That means seeing them as part of the whole sweep of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament.
Yeah, for Christians.
Fundamentally, understanding them in light of Jesus's teachings, especially things like the Sermon on the Mount.
And Jesus's approach, the source highlights, was less about the letter and more about the vah.
The intention or the spirit behind the law. He consistently pushed beyond just the external action to the internal attitude, the heart. Think of his comments on anger being related to murder or lust to adultery. He wasn't abolishing the law, but showing its deeper internal demands. It's like he takes that 10th commandment about internal desire and applies its principle back to the others.
Right, that idea of the letter kills, but the spirit gives life.
Exactly. It's about the heart transformation that leads to right action, not just forcing external compliance.
So this brings us right to the big question. What is the Christian obligation, if any, to these commandments today? It's debated, right?
Oh, definitely. It's a point of ongoing discussion. Some argue they're completely set aside for Christians, often focusing on the Sabbath command as proof, since most Christians don't observe it in the same way ancient Israel did.
But what's the view presented in the source material we're looking at?
The source argues, based largely on Jesus' own words, you know, "I have not come to abolish the law or the prophets, but to fulfill them," that the Old Testament law, including the Ten Commandments, is not simply obsolete or irrelevant for Christians.
Not abolished, but fulfilled. What does fulfill mean here?
Well, the source suggests fulfillment isn't necessarily something that happened completely and finished at Jesus' death. It likely points towards the ultimate fullness of his kingdom.
The future.
Yeah, the time when, as the prophet Jeremiah foretold, God's law will be fully written upon our hearts. In that state, external rules become less necessary because people's internal desires and wills are aligned with God's. That's the ultimate fulfillment.
So what about now, in the meantime?
In the meantime, the application for Christians, according to this view, is about living out the intention or the spirit of these instructions, as interpreted and deepened by Jesus. It's about striving, through the help of the Spirit, to live in a way that pleases God, embodying the underlying principles of love for God and love for neighbor that these commandments express.
Okay, so zooming back out then, if we had to boil down the key takeaway from this deep dive into the source material, what would it be?
I think it's that the Ten Commandments are just far more intricate, more nuanced, and frankly, more interesting than the simple list of rules they're often made out to be.
They're not just rules, they're
covenant stipulations, more like solemn vows made within a very specific relationship with God. They were designed for a particular ancient society, not as a universal blueprint.
And they show surprising flexibility, even ambiguity sometimes. And they address both what we do and what's going on inside us, in our hearts and minds.
Exactly. There's a profound wisdom woven into their structure and their content that goes way beyond just external enforcement or simple do's and don'ts.
And for anyone trying to understand their relevance today, context is everything.
Absolutely. Remembering their original ancient Near Eastern context, and especially for Christians, filtering them through the transformative teaching of Jesus that focuses on the spirit and intention, that's really key to unlocking their deeper meaning.
Okay, so here's a final thought to leave with you, the listener, based on all this. If the very last commandment, the 10th one, the culmination of this foundational list, is the one that deals purely with our inner, largely unenforceable state, "You shall not covet." What does that suggest about where true adherence to God's instruction, true keeping of the covenant, ultimately begins? Where is the real focus, and perhaps where is it most deeply judged?